Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
This episode of Zero Block 30 is brought to you by our folks at Harry's. You might be like, well, hey, what the fuck is Harry's? Harry's is razors. For decades, one big razor company has relentlessly increased prices and reaped immense profits at the expense of its consumers, namely you. And shitty razor blades have been like 17 cents forever, but those things fucking suck. Like, they're the kind that they gave us at boot camp when I first started shaving. I didn't even have hair on my face when I first showed up to boot camp and at Paris Island, and it still would rip out my non-existent hair from my face. You don't have to do that. You don't have to spend a ton of money, or you don't have to be cheap as fuck. You can get some for a moderate price. Harry's is so confident that you'll love their blades that they are giving you a trial set for free. All you got to do is cover the free shipping. Your free trial sets includes a weighted razor blade, a 5 precision engineer blade with lubricating strip and beard trimmer, a little trimmer blade, a rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover, which is nice if you travel like me do. That's a $13 value for you to try. So all you have to do is stop messing around, get off your lazy ass, pick up your phone, and order the free trial today, and just cover the shipping. Go to harrys.com/chaps, that's C-H-A-P-S, chaps, right now. Get that at harrys.com/chaps. Cons, how are you doing, my friend?
I am doing very well. We got a rainy day here in New York, but I'm doing well otherwise. It seems like it's not bad weather down there at Augusta, Georgia, so I'm looking across the table in the studio here. I'm not seeing our boy Riggs. Riggs is fast becoming the king of the boondoggle. I mean,
he is.
That's great that, I mean, Foreplay is killing it. I think it's an awesome podcast. I listen to it myself. But to have a podcast and a job that affords you the opportunity to go to Augusta for the Masters, that's fantastic. So good for Riggs.
It's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I think everybody would love to go down there.
Mm-hmm.
But we're stuck here, and we're not even stuck. We're just living life. Like, I have good weather here. It's like 65 degrees, which is nice. It's usually hot as fuck here, so actually pretty decent weather.
We got good weather coming next week up here when you're in town. We got great weather
coming. I'll be back up in New York on Monday, so that'll be good. We'll have some good interviews. We got some great interviews coming with Jason Kander, Megan Levy from the new movie Levy, and a few others that are going to be just great interviews coming up. We have a heavy show
today. Yeah, I was going to say, we had some great interviews just today on this show.
Yeah, we've been having a little bit of lighter time, like kind of stay away from politics for a little bit. And this isn't really political issues that we're talking about. This is basically straight up war and the reasons why we go to war. So we'll have a gentleman named Thomas that comes on, and is a reporter from the Washington Post. And then we have an NBC captain, which is nuclear biological chemical, that's going to come on after that and talk about what happened in Syria with the gassing. And those are very, very heavy issues. I mean, you can't really talk about Syria and Mosul and be like, well, let's just lightheartedly joke about it.
Yeah, there's not many jokes to say. Although, a little on the lighter side, chaps, I applaud you for being brave and allowing two Army captains to be on the show at one time.
Yeah, so, it was a struggle for me for sure. I mean, you know, two Army guys, let alone two Army officers at the same time it goes against everything that I'm about, but I mean, I care about our listeners, so I think it was worth it. And he did a great job, so you'll hear that moving on. This past, I think it's 9 weeks. I'm not sure how many weeks it was exactly. It's been pretty dark for me on Sunday evenings. And
oh, yeah.
I know it has been for you.
Yep.
And I talked about it a little bit, and we didn't really get into it, but we will now. Me and you both have been watching a show called Big Little Lies.
Yeah, great show.
Kind of tell the people who don't know what Big Little Lies are, kind of tell them what's it about.
So Big Little Lies is adapted from a novel, which I did not read the book, but from what I can understand, it's your classic beach read in the summer. It's these women in Monterey, California, mothers, and they all have children that go to the same public school. And it's kind of a look behind the scenes in the underbelly that these women all appear to have great lives. When you go behind the scenes, you pull up the curtain, or pull back the curtain, rather, you get to see a little bit more of the beast, and things aren't always what they seem, and just how they intertwine with one another. And it was on HBO, so if you haven't seen Big Little Lies, it's just a miniseries, 7 episodes, hour-long episodes. I would definitely recommend it, because you got a star-studded cast. You got Reese Witherspoon, you got Nicole Kidman, really the two big names
leading that cast.
Zoe Kravitz, sorry. I'm blanking on the gentleman's name.
The dude
now.
That was in Generation Kill.
Right, right. And
some Swedish name or some shit.
Adam Scott as well plays Reese's husband, Ed. So, I mean, you got a great cast.
The music is fantastic.
The music is fantastic, and here's the only qualm I have with this show.
Wait, let's stop for a minute. Okay. I want to go back before I forget something.
Okay.
People who read on the beach blow my mind.
Why?
Why the fuck do you do that? I feel like that's the worst place to read. It's so fucking bright, man. Like, on the beach, it's just so bright. And you're going to get weird tan lines. I'll say this, too. I'm going to go out. I know it's because people are going to assume, just because I'm a ginger. If you lay out to get a suntan and you're hanging out on the beach, you're a weirdo, in my opinion. I feel like that's the most weirdo shit to do.
I feel like girls do that more than guys. I feel like I just get sun just being at the beach. I don't actively, like, say, like, I want to go to the beach to get sun. Just from being on the beach, sitting in the chair, listening to music, playing some beach games. My big thing that I love to do, I like to go for a long walk down the beach. I'll be like,
big
I'm going for a walk,
yeah,
and I'll be back in like an hour.
Yeah,
that's a great way to get sun and, you know, get some exercise in. That's my go-to. I can't lay there. I can't just sit still at the beach. Like, some people like just love to like just sit there and do nothing. I can't do that.
And I don't feel like you have to be active either. I don't feel like it has to be something where you're like throwing a football or playing badminton or volleyball or whatever. Just put me in the water about shoulder height, a little bit lower, short, like armpit height.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a few beers. I can stand there and talk to my pals all day, just like hanging out in the cool water. Because if you're on the beach, like especially where I'm from in Pensacola, Florida, the sand is white.
Oh, Pensacola is the best.
It is hot as shit, dude. Mm-hmm. Like you're just sitting there. The sand is hot. You're hot the entire time. You're right close to the water. Get your dumb ass in the water.
Yeah, no, there are definitely days.
You're still going to get sun.
There are definitely days in Jersey where it's almost too hot, like you said, just to sit on the beach and just be there. But
sand all up in your dick and your ass crack? No, dude.
We only have a few beaches in New Jersey that are like, we have some private beaches where you can drink on the beach. Otherwise, you can't drink on the beach. So that's another reason I don't want to stay at the beach too long, because, you know, Saturday afternoon, like, I want to be having a few beers with my pals, and can't do that on the beach, then I don't want to stay there that long.
All right, let's do Mary Fuck Kill. Mary Fuck Kill, beaches, lakes, rivers.
Oh, because you can float. People forget, you float rivers, you get in a tube. Mm-hmm. Oh, man. I think just because, so I've done all three, but I think I'm killing rivers just because when you're doing it, it's great, but I feel like getting there and then floating and then walking to a bus or back to your car, that can be a little bit of a pain. So I'm going to kill rivers. I'm going to marry beaches, because those would be the constant in my life, just like a good woman would be. And I'll fuck lakes, because guess what, man? Used to live down in Austin and Lake Travis. You get out there, you do some wakeboarding, or you go and you tie up with a bunch of boats. And that is a special kind of fun, let me tell you. When you just tie up in Lake Travis and you can go to any other boat full of strangers, climb aboard their boat, and you will be offered a beer and said, like, oh, hey, hello, what's up, man? How are you? No questions asked. It's an awesome time.
I have a lake that's like 10 miles from my house that is the same. It looks exactly the same as Lake Travis. It's called Lake Medina, and it's really close to me. Mm-hmm. And that's where I take my boat out on shit. So I am going to go with Mary Lakes. Fuck a river, kill the beaches.
Okay.
Because anything that you can do on the beach, you can do it better on a lake, except surf. But
yeah,
you
so
just can't.
Yeah,
like
so
you have Why would you not want to walk out of your house to on grass to get to the water and then get to a dock instead of taking all your dumb shit where you can barely walk straight, crunching your ass through the sand, having flip-flops on, sending up sand straight up through your butthole? Fuck the beach, man. Like, and I'm from like 10 minutes from the beach. Fuck the beach.
Yeah, sand is definitely the big downfall of the beach.
All right, so but let's anyway. let's get back to Big Little Lies. That
Big
was a
Little
nice
Lies.
Little yeah. Let's get back to Big Little Lies.
I like reading on the beach, by the way.
So we're gonna do some. No, that's terrible. So we're gonna get back to some the ending. So if you haven't listened to Big Little Lies, smash that 15-second forward button because I mainly just want to talk about the ending.
Okay.
Where we had some disagreements. Kind of tell the people what happened in the end.
Well. Spoiler alert, if you haven't watched, turn off or fast forward, like Chap said. So the really douchey guy, the douchey husband who beats Nicole Kidman's character,
Perry,
he finds out that she wants to basically separate from him. She gets her own apartment. He finds out that she went behind his back, got an apartment. She's going to take the kids and basically run away from him.
And the dude's like a monster, like beats the shit out of her.
Yeah, like scary. And then they try to justify it throughout the therapy sessions. Like, oh, but then we have really passionate sex afterwards. Like, that makes it okay. That's not okay. But so he confronts her and she's with all her girls. All the other main female characters are there. And he confronts her and she's not willing to go with him, so eventually he just goes after her, and he starts beating her right in front of all her girlfriends, and they all gang up on him, and they're trying to save their friend, which is admirable. And then Zoe Kravitz's character, Bonnie, from the freaking rafters, watches all this happen, and then he's by the edge of a concrete staircase. She runs from behind, throws him down the staircase, and he landed on, like, a stick, right?
Yep.
Through his throat and killed
stick
him.
Stick to the neck.
Yeah, stick to the neck. Gets him every time and kills him. And then that was it. And then it ends with they all go down to the police station and they all tell the same lie. And then that is where it ends, basically. And then they show them all on the beach with their children frolicking about on the beach. And I like the ending, but I think that you had some other thoughts.
Yeah, I think that it's just because how complicated the show was, because Zoe Kravitz's character hated Reese Witherspoon's character.
I think that was the other way around. I think Zoe
no,
was...
No, yeah, Zoe Kravitz didn't hate her.
Yeah,
it
she
was
making the effort.
The
Reese
she
didn't
was,
like
she
her.
Was pretty good. But the other characters, everybody had conflict. Mm-hmm. And it was like this whole dramatic show with this moving music that was just really perfect for how everything went. And then for everybody to come together at the last minute and, oh, it works out. The kids are going to have their dead dad because they're not going to turn into they're not going to turn into monsters like Perry. And Nicole is going to be able to raise them in a nice community, and everybody's going to get along now since Bonnie killed the guy. Now Reese Witherspoon and Bonnie's characters are going to get along so well because they had this cathartic moment. And it's just not satisfying. I wanted fucking Nicole Kidman's character, Celeste. I wanted her to pull a gun and shoot that motherfucker in the face. Like, he deserved a violent death, not like, ooh, whoopsie daisies, fell down the stairs and landed on a stick, and now I'm dead.
Nah, like, but I
there
I
needed
think...
to be a more violent death, the satisfying death. Like, the death that the dude had in Game of Thrones, who was it? Ramsay, right?
I'll take your word for it. I don't watch Game of Thrones, remember.
Lord Bolton.
Yeah.
Where he got ate up by the dogs. Mm-hmm. That was a satisfying death for a villain. This was not that. I left the show. I was angry. My wife was like, this is better than the book.
Okay.
Ending.
All right. Two things. One thing I did read about the book that was different. Bonnie had more of a backstory where she was in an abusive relationship, and that's why she reacted that way. But yeah. Here's why I think it is a good ending. Because Perry plays the monster the entire time, and I think it is sweet poetic justice that it is Bonnie, the smallest, most down-to-earth, fragile, docile of all those women, non-confrontational of all those women, for her to be the one to take down the monster, I think that's where the poetic justice lies. And then on top of that, it's not as clear as it appears. On that beach scene, it's like, oh, like everything's great. When in fact, these women now all have to live with that secret the rest of their life. You remember the detective said, listen to all their stories. All the language is too similar. I know they're lying. She knew it for a fact they were lying, but obviously she can't prove it because they're all, you know, in lockstep with their stories. But that's something I've never been in that situation where I pushed someone downstairs and killed them. But I can imagine they all have to live with that lie deep down inside of them for the rest of their life. So they're leading a conflicted life, and that bonds them. But at the same time, it bonds them in a way that people wouldn't necessarily want to be bonded. And I think it's important to note that the very last frame before it goes dark, you see someone watching from binoculars, and you hear that lighter, that Zippo lighter. It's the detective who is going to pursue them and keep an eye on them till she can one day prove that they are, in fact, have a big little lie that they are all sharing. So I thought the
but
ending
they didn't
was great.
Do anything. They didn't do anything.
So but that's you, no. But see, that's that where it lets you let your mind think and you let
but
you
they
go.
They showed you that they don't know what's going on. So I think that's bullshit. They should have fired him off through a cannon or something, like to make me feel better.
All right,
but
that's fair.
We'll move on from Big Little Lies, and we'll move into our discussion on Syria. So we're going to bring in Thomas from the Washington Post. Here we go. It's also brought to you by the good folks at Lisa Mattresses. This interview is going to be brought to you by the folks at Lisa Mattresses. Today's episode is brought to you by Lisa Mattress because they are an innovative mattress company, and more important, Larry 2 sponsor, RIP, who has completely improved the dreaded old mattress buying experience. If you don't know who Larry 2 is, you need to get on board with Larry 2 because he was the best betting goldfish in the game. And Lisa Mattresses are the best mattresses in the game. You can have a Lisa mattress with a 100-night risk-free trial along with free shipping so that you can properly try out the mattress in the comfort of your home. You can fuck on it. You could do whatever you want to. They don't care. Sex stains, whatever. It's going to come out. It's going to smell good. My daughter says the bed smells like chocolate, which is kind of creepy. I don't know if you want it to smell like chocolate, but that's better than smelling like piss like your old mattress probably does. So go to Lisa Mattress and get a Lisa mattress at lisa.com/barstool and receive an exclusive $75 off the Lisa mattress just for the Stoolies, Zero Block 30 listeners. Lisa.com/barstool for $75 off. Well, now on Zero Block 30, we'd like to welcome a special guest who works for the Washington Post and is a former United States Marine, much like myself. His name is Thomas Gibbons Neff. Thomas, welcome to Zero Block 30, my friend.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you were a little bit different. Not a lot of people go from being like Marines to working for the Washington Post. Can you kind of give us a little bit of background of what you did in the Marine Corps just to give our viewers and listeners a heads up?
Yeah, for sure. So I was an enlisted Marine. I enlisted kind of right out of high school. I actually went to college for a semester and dropped out and joined in 07. So I was in the I was an 0311, which is infantry. It's the MOS number, I guess, for that. And, did two deployments with 1st Battalion, 6th Marines, 2008 to Helmand, Afghanistan, and then 2009, 2010 back to Helmand, and then got out in 2011 and applied to school on the GI Bill and ended up getting into Georgetown miraculously. My platoon commander was a former lacrosse player, like my platoon commander as I was leaving the Marine Corps. So he helped me get some alumni interviews and kind of weaseled my way in there. And basically just went to Georgetown as kind of an older freshman and kind of figured my way out through there and started writing some pieces about kind of the veteran experience. And, I got an internship at the Washington Post, and they hired me in 2015.
When you were getting out of the Marines, is that what you wanted to do, was to go back and be a journalist covering the kind of stuff that you do now?
No, I really had no clue. I kind of just knew that I wanted to have kind of both experiences and had some thoughts of maybe coming back in or I was originally going to re-enlist. I was going to re-enlist in country and then ended up coming back, looking around the barracks and being like, yeah, you know what, maybe not.
And Georgetown certainly is a nice alternative when you think about it.
Yeah, big step up from HB 425 down there at Camp Lejeune.
Yeah, I'd imagine going from the barracks and infantry battalion to what you see walking around campus at Georgetown is just a touch different.
Yeah, definitely a lot more friendlier crowd.
So, kind of explain what your job is with the Washington Post, what you do.
Yeah, so I am a, I guess you call it a national security reporter. I kind of cover the Pentagon as my my main job and kind of do, stuff on the back burner for other beats, have done some overseas work. But yeah, mostly be covering the U.S. military.
I mean, did you come in the door at the Washington Post and they said, oh, you're a Marine, so boom, you go cover the U.S. military? Or was that something you just felt because of your background you'd be more comfortable, so you kind of jockeyed for position to get that sort of beat?
It was kind of more the former. It's kind of they were just starting this vertical or blog called Checkpoint, and they asked me if, I would help out with that kind of during my first internship, and that's just kind of where I built my spot. But, I mean, that being said, I mean, my knowledge base kind of lends itself to this kind of writing. So, I mean, I don't really have a problem being pigeonholed or buttonholed in on one specialty. It's just kind of how it worked out.
So have you been covering it for both administrations? Were you in the Obama administration as well?
Yep. Yeah. So I started really in 2014. So I was covering all that through the election, and here we are.
And I'd imagine you've seen some drastic differences in what you've been covering between the two administrations.
I mean, definitely in rhetoric as far as military strategy and kind of how the Pentagon has been doing business, not so much. It's been pretty consistent. I guess the only, thing I've really been able to trace is just kind of, maybe some backdoor jockeying by, the Special Operations Command's JSOC specifically to kind of keep a, keep its op tempo through the Obama administration and the Trump administration. They kind of built themselves as a nice niche under Obama as his go-to, and I think they're trying to maintain that under Trump.
So a couple of weeks ago, you wrote an article that an airstrike monitoring group was overwhelmed by claims of U.S.-caused casualties.
Yep.
What was their main beef? Because I've seen some charts and shit like that where the amount of drone strikes that we've done in March specifically, it's the highest number that we've had in a very long time. Is that kind of what they were upset about, or what was the deal behind that?
Yeah, I mean, basically it's op tempo, right, operational tempo. You have the Raqqa campaign kind of moving along, and you have the Mosul campaign in full swing. So basically, without U.S. ground troops, our air support is kind of the main delivery of firepower, backed up by artillery. So with these campaigns kind of I would say Mosul's definitely at fever pitch and Raqqa's certainly escalating. You just have a lot of aircraft in the area, have a lot of ordnance getting dropped, and basically these claims, this is a small group, Air Wars, based out of the UK, is a small group of journalists and researchers who basically, have local activists on the ground combing through social media that, basically pick up, hey, there was a strike here. It could be from the U.S. It could be from, one of our international partners. And basically they log it and then they start going about verifying it. So just the fact that there's been so much air activity, so much, airstrikes, and maybe, you have a lot of these populations being contained in their cities, Mosul and Raqqa, the area around it, I mean, there's going to be civilians on the ground, so they have to go about kind of parsing through information. Is this a legitimate strike? And they have a pretty good relationship with the U.S. Central Command, who they kind of pass information to be like, hey, this is legit, this isn't legit kind of stuff.
Do you ever find it difficult or challenging for yourself to stay impartial as a journalist, considering your background as an infantry Marine and your viewpoints on various conflicts, how they might have been when you were a Marine versus now?
Yeah, I mean, I think the only time it's remotely difficult really is with Afghanistan. That's certainly what I consider my war and something that I, have an affinity to, just spending time there and losing people that I cared about and kind of coming back and watching them deal with it and kind of Well, not them. I mean, all of us, I guess. So that's the only time it gets difficult, you know, just sitting in a newsroom and hearing places that you were 10 years ago or 7 years ago or whatever, kind of get that it's still getting talked about and it's, you know, no better than it was when you were there. It's kind of frustrating. But as far as, you know, covering the military writ large and, you know, civilian casualties, I mean, you kind of understand how the machine works, right? And you kind of get it. And I think that itself, I mean, it lends itself to a weird type of impartiality just because you kind of know what it's up to. I mean, it doesn't lend any more affinity or less affinity. It's just kind of an innate knowledge of how things are kind of going to play out, if that makes any sense.
No, it definitely does, right? Because, you know, when I think about airstrikes and drone strikes, I think that's one issue where you can kind of see there are people making arguments for both sides. There's some people say, hey, that's a great way for us to be involved as the U.S., and other people say we should have more boots on ground. So that was really just where my question was stemming from. But, you know, that's an interesting take for you that, you know, it really only comes into play when you think about Afghanistan in particular.
Yeah, I mean, again, I mean, you know, when there is there is that emotional pull, right? It's an easy thing to detect. And then the rest, you know, it's not something that overwhelms. And if there's any kind of, you know, writing that I might think, hey, you know, maybe I can't be partial or impartial, you know, I'll tell the editors or whatever. But I mean, that's never happened. So,
and we talk about a lot on this show. We talk about something called war fatigue, where the public at large, I think they're just fatigued from hearing about war. And I think that whenever we have such an impartial media where it's just fact-based, this is what happened, and not showing the background of what actually went on, I feel like we lose a little bit of that. You recently wrote an article about the airstrike in Mosul that you said potentially was the worst U.S.-led civilian bombing in the 25 years. Can you give us a little bit of background about that article?
Yeah, so I mean, that's kind of exactly why I wanted to write it, right, is that you get, you know, you get these numbers kind of thrown at you and they seem ridiculous, and, you know, 200, 300 people is a lot of people, and that's, I mean, that's a tough number to kind of wrap your head around. So the idea was to kind of put it in context of what, you know, strikes in the past have been similar to the Mosul strike, kind of their ramifications on U.S. policy. And, I mean, basically what you see is that, you know, there was a couple of these, you know, large casualty, you know, mass CAS airstrikes in 2009 that really kind of dictated how the Afghanistan war played out, looking at Stanley McChrystal's, General McChrystal's rules of engagement that were pushed down, that, you know, had a massive backlash with the guys on the ground and politicians back home, and eventually, you know, kind of was this weird time between 2009 and 2010 where, you know, people couldn't really figure out what was going on with, you know, whether it be ROE or how we were approaching the conflict. So, you know, looking at what happened in Mosul, I mean, same kind of deal. Like, what are the implications going to be of that many? That being said, you know, was there an airstrike? Yes. Was that airstrike solely responsible for the deaths? I mean, that remains to be seen. I mean, we know the Islamic State has used human shields, made pumped buildings full of explosives in an attempt to kind of lure U.S. airstrikes or coalition airstrikes in there. So, I mean, we'll see. We'll see with the investigation. Not saying that's like the final word, but I mean, there's probably more here than just one airstrike and 300 dead people.
I mean, do you think ultimately we will get a clear picture, a clear answer in the end?
No, I mean, there's no, I mean, you get scrapes of it, and then, you know, you kind of hedge it the best you can, and hopefully you can see the forest through the trees, or wherever that saying goes, but that's just the nature of it right now. I mean, social media helps. I think, you know, the amount of information that's out there, you can kind of come to your own conclusion, not just rely on single source stuff. But at the end of the day, this is a dense urban environment with a lot of people on the ground and a lot of bombs in the air, and
do you look at it, knowing what you do, about civilian casualties and how they've upticked in the last 3 or 4 months, and then hear a quote from General Mattis where he's talking about we go absolutely out of our way to avoid civilian casualties? Do you view that as ironic, and how do you feel about that quote?
No, I don't think it's ironic. I think, like, you know, writ large, the U.S. has probably been, you know, the most proactive about, you know, whether that's precision guided munitions, rules of engagement. I mean, I was in Afghanistan and last year, you know, watched a string of airstrikes come down the pipe, and you know, there was a very kinetic situation with forces on the ground, and it was still, you know, done the best you can in that, and you know, with a lot of care being taken to mitigate, you know, make sure that they were hitting the right targets. And that wasn't just because I was in the room. I was pretty much a fly on the wall, and it was, you know, if I was there, I wasn't there, it wouldn't have gone any different. But I mean, when Mattis says that, I mean, I think that comes from a good place, and I don't scoff at it. But at the same time, you know, we do have a lot of, you know, we have drones, surveillance aircraft, bombs that can go through windows, you know, 2.75 guided rockets that can, you know, basically come off an F-16 and hit a guy like a sniper rifle round. So, I mean, when you have these abilities, you know, they need to be leveraged correctly. And, you know, when the press kind of comes down super hard on one strike, and, you know, you have brass kind of being like, well, you're not talking about how terrible the Islamic State is. Like, you know, we're not, I'm not a journalist from the Islamic State, and it's kind of apples to oranges, right? I mean, we're talking about the U.S. military, and when you kind of come out and say this is the most accurate air campaign in history, then you're going to be held to that, right? When civilians start dying, like, yes, I get it. The war is a complicated endeavor, and even more so in a fight like Mosul, but I mean, that doesn't change, you know, how we're going to do our job.
Yeah.
Do you find, and this just to lighten it up some, I know whenever I was deployed, we hated fucking journalists being with us. And I know you as an O3 guy, you probably fucking hated having journalists with you too. Do you like kind of commiserate, like go into the room at first and be like, guys, I know that you fucking hate that I'm here, but like I have a new job. This is my new mission.
100%. I mean, my second appointment is like, hey, we don't talk to journalists. Like if you want to talk, like it's, you know, get away from me. If you get caught in the paper, you're buying everyone a 30 rack. Like it's kind of, yeah. And like, think about it. I mean, you're out there, you're embedded, you're in like, you know, in Afghanistan doing patrol to patrol. And they're like, hey, we want you to take this dude with you. Like, I don't know who this guy is. I don't know, you know, what his, you know, is he emotionally stable? Like, is he physically able to hack it if we have to, you know, like, and, yeah, I mean, a friend of mine, he went out in Ramadi with Laura Logan's team in 06, I think it was like, or 05, 06 with 3-8, and he basically told her, like, you know, if you get shot in the middle of the street, I'm not sending my guys to go get you. You know, you're not.
Yeah, man. Like, I'm sure as a Marine, you've read or you're familiar with Generation Kill, and whenever that whole book was going on, when Evan Wright is with 1st Recon Battalion, I feel like that's one of the most accurate pictures of being a journalist, is that everybody calls you journalist. They don't even know your name for the most part. They just call you by your billet, and they don't want you there because they know that nothing's good. They're not going to report anything good that you did for the most part. It's just going to be what you did that was bad that gets brought up.
Yeah, I mean, I totally sympathize with that, and that was definitely mine, but my take, I guess. But I guess, you know, being on the flip side as a journalist, like, I still totally appreciate that, but at the same time, like, you know, I've kind of come to realize, like, you know, in the last few, like, when you're there, I mean, nothing's yours, right? I mean, you didn't buy that rifle. You're not. I mean, it's all at the behest of the American taxpayer. You know, in some way, shape, or form, the people of this country elected people into office who decided to, you know, send troops to Afghanistan, and like, you know, as a journalist, I'm kind of there just making sure the investment is the right one, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and that's it's a tough thing to convey, and it's, you know, it sounds probably at the end of the day pretty naive, but I mean, it's the only way you can really justify it, because, you know, you know, 15 years of this stuff, and we're bombing Somalia, Libya, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria. I'm sure I missed like 7 in there or something, but you know, like,
we're bombing basically everybody.
Right, exactly. I mean, there needs to be some kind of check on that, and which is tough. I mean, like Syria, you can't get a journalist in there, you know, worth a dang because of conditions on the ground, and the U.S. government isn't really helping with embeds. So, you know, we don't really know how that really looks, except like local activists, reports on social media, etc. So, you know, it's a tough line to walk.
Yeah. So to your point about, you know, being on the other side of the coin now, you know, you talked about our precision-guided missiles, you talked about our ROE, rules of engagement, and to the extent that we train and talk to our military, I think, as you alluded to, the U.S. does a better job than anyone going to extreme lengths to make sure that our rules of engagement are followed. Do you ever find yourself with your peers now, your other journalists, when they want to come down on the military and you have to want to have that urge or maybe subdue that urge to jump in and like scold your fellow journalists and say, guys, you don't understand. Like, they're trained on this, so if it happened, they did all the right things. Do you ever want to like jump down their throats sometimes?
Yeah, it's not so much. I mean, it's like it's education, right? Like, it all comes down to, again, you know how the machine works. Like, you know, I was a JFO. You know, wasn't like a, had to be a staff sergeant to be a JTAC, but you kind of know the mechanics that go into calling an airstrike, which, if it's done correctly, is like a pretty painstaking process. You know, like, there's a lot that goes into it to make sure that weapon comes off the rails where it's supposed to go. And it's, you know, so when we're talking about, like, hey, X, Y, and Z, you know, whether that's weaponeering, you know, what was the final attack, you know, stuff like that. It's more just being like, hey, you know, maybe there is something wrong here, but maybe that angle isn't the right way, right? Like, but at the end of the day, you're writing for publications that are, you know, consumed by the general public. So you have to write for the general public. So some of the nuance that maybe that I'd like to get in there has to kind of get stripped out and words get put in that are, you know, encompass the same concept, but aren't as precise as they might have to be in a situation like this, if that makes any sense. But, you know,
no, it makes perfect
for the most
sense,
part,
yeah.
For the most part, like, you know, everyone in the Pentagon press corps that I've met are, you know, great people and have the best intentions. It's just, you know, sometimes stuff comes out a little sideways. And I'm the same way. Stuff, you know, I'm not perfect either. And, you know, again, like, you're writing from, you know, 50,000 feet. You're not on the ground. Like, again, with the Mosul strike, we'll never – who will know what will happen? You know, the Iraqi forward observer, the JTAC on the Horn, the guy who, you know, dropped the bomb. Like, that's it. Everything else is a game of telephone.
And that's a dangerous game of telephone when, you know, eventually it gets back to the American public and they're wondering what's going on halfway across the world. So, I mean, right. that is a very hard duty for you and your other journalists to make sure that you get it as right as possible. Because obviously
right.
the American public has a right to know as taxpayers, as you said, you know, giving our military those tools from which to work. So it is a difficult task, and I think we recognize that. Or at least I hope most people recognize that.
Yeah, and I mean, at the end, I mean, these are dead. These are dead family. Like, these are, you know, women, children, you know, people who are dying. And I mean, I think there's a certain responsibility there, right? So I mean, it's a tough line to walk. But
and that's part of the problem that what happened in Syria with the gas. With the gassing this week, I mean, we, like you said, it's hard to get journalists in there to know exactly what happened. Like, the Syrian government saying that it was the opposition forces, Russia saying that it wasn't them, like they weren't involved, but really we don't know. It's just terrible because we have no idea what actually went happened. We can't prove anything, and I don't know if we ever will be able to prove anything with that.
Right, and I mean that I'd call it a truth vacuum, right? I mean, that's almost, you know, its own weapon, because basically you don't have, I mean, you have so many competing agendas on the ground, and that's kind of been built up over the past, you know, 5 years, that it's almost its own. You have an incident like this, and no matter who did it or how it happened, I mean, there's a million ways for it to get spun, just because there are no journalists on it, for a bunch of different reasons that are all kind of byproducts of every faction, whether, you know, it's the Assad bombing campaign, whether it's, you know, terrorist groups, capturing Western journalists and those Western governments paying ransoms, which has, you know, pretty much eliminated any type of, you know, Western journal, you know, media incursion into certain parts of Syria. So, I mean, and, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's a war on kind of ground truth that, you know, makes a kind of a fertile ground for false flag conspiracies or, you know, whatever side wants to, you know, show whatever evidence that kind of backs up their argument. So it's a mess.
How hip do you think Assad, as an example, is to that factor that he knows, well, I could do something and then it's so the water's so murky, I could just pass it off like, I don't know, that wasn't me.
I think, I mean, just, you know, see some of his statements, you know, we don't drop barrel bombs, we don't use chemical weapons. You know, it's obvious that he's operating in that area, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, there's, you know, you look at the White Helmets, right? They're, you know, they've got an Oscar-nominated documentary or, you know, they're kind of seen as Western media darlings, and then what did the Russians do? The Russians spin them as, you know, Al-Qaeda-funded, you know, Western-funded, you know, terrorists who pose as X, Y, and Z. You know what I'm saying? Using bits and footage. I mean, it's just, again, like, and you can kind of subscribe to whatever you want, right? And so as a journalist, what do? I mean, which narrative do you pick, or do you try and entertain every single narrative when you write any piece about this stuff? I mean, these are questions that you're going to have to wade through writing about it. I mean, at the end of the day, is that a kid dying from sarin gas exposure? Yes. I mean, those are what the symptoms look like, right? I mean, and we're not Hollywood grade special effects. So then how do you parse it back from there? You know, you look at the imagery, you look at who was on the ground, you talk to, you know, you try and do everything you can, but at the end of the day, the lack of resources on the ground, you know, allows for whoever to take advantage of whatever information they want.
Which is exactly why they have it that way, so they can continue to pump their propaganda machine. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's frustrating. Well, thanks, Thomas, for coming on, man. We really appreciate your time. I always love to see former Marines doing great shit, and you're doing great shit for the Washington Post. And we'll post some links to your articles, your article that you posted today about some of the never before published photos of the World War One intro was pretty amazing. Like reading those captions, I really enjoyed that. So we'll post some of those too. You could check out Thomas's work on the Washington Post at all times.
Much appreciated.
Yep. Thank you, Thomas, so much. We appreciate your insight and giving us time. And, you know, I encourage all our listeners to read more of your work and your articles, because obviously you come at it from both angles, the military, but also you have an oath as a journalist as well to tell the truth and get it out there to the American public, and that's very much appreciated. So thank you very much for coming on and sharing your time with us.
Yeah, for sure, and thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And I'd like to get on the record that makes at least two Marines that can write, so that's cool. All right, dude. Thank you, man.
All right, take care.
This week I've been doing a lot of cooking since I've been home, and I'll be out of town last week, and I've been doing a lot more cooking videos, and some of the stuff that I like to use is from our good friends at Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone, and it achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. It has established partners with 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. Blue Apron can be delivered to 99% of the continental United States and 99.5% of the food deserts. Because Blue Apron ships the exact amount of ingredients required for a recipe, they are reducing food waste. And your trash doesn't stink, which is a big, big plus, because nobody wants their trash to smell like big old fucking nutsacks. Cooking together builds a strong family bond. I did it yesterday with my daughter on Snapchat. We made some chicken together. She got to season it. She got to put it in the pan. She nearly burned her fucking hand off, but it's something that was worth it because she likes to cook, and I like teaching her how to cook. Family strong bonds. Those who spend a lot at restaurants at high-end grocery stores can now spend under $10 a person for a delicious meal. And depending on where you live, that ain't shit. Like in New York, if you live in New York, it's like $9 for a gallon of milk or some shit. So just get blueapron.com/zero. You'll get three free meals. That's three free meals with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/zero. You will love how good it feels and tastes to be an incredible home-cooked meal kind of person instead of just eating McDonald's or whatever, fast food every single night. blueapron.com. It's a better way to cook. blueapron.com/chaps. Also, it's brought to you by the good folks at barstoolsports.com/ZBT. You can get your ZBT shirts. We have more stuff coming out. We have dog collars coming out. We have all kinds of shit coming out. We have socks. We have hats. We have everything coming out. Go support your boys on the podcast with our Zero Block 30 gear. It helps us get the word out about the podcast. You can pick your favorite branch of service that you like to rep if you're not an active duty member, veteran, or whatever. I recommend the Marine Corps one. It really pops. Everybody's eyes look great in olive drab. We use a nice little olive drab color. Go to Zero Block 30 in the Barstool Sports store. Check it out. All the other stuff is good. If you like your one bite pizza shirts, if you like your Saturdays for the boy shit, if you're a big part of my take fan, they have all that stuff there as well. There's going to be a summer launch coming out soon that'll be all the different things for summer. So go to Zero Block 30 spot in the store, barstoolsports.com/ZBT. Yeah, and the best part about that interview with Thomas was, I don't want to say the best part, was just the openness of what it actually looks like whenever the children who were gassed were shown. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like we, as a public, shy away from those. And I've been on the fence, and I think we talked about it with Riggs when we talked about what was happening in Syria before, that seeing civilian casualties
right
is rough, like, and it always is rough
because it's always so raw. It's very raw. Like, you see stuff like that in movies, raw. TV, whatever, it looks a certain way and it might be a little unsettling, but then you see it in real life and you're like, I didn't know what to expect, but I didn't expect that.
And it's shocking, like, especially with as involved we are on social media, whenever you log into something like Twitter or Facebook and different news outlets will have just the pictures or videos of the children writhing in pain or their parents running them to the hospital. And I feel like that's something at this point as Americans we need to see, because I do believe that war fatigue is terrible and we're running out of adjectives. There's only so many times you could say horrific, war crimes,
yeah,
crimes against humanity, disgusting, despicable. Like, you can throw out all these different adjectives that basically mean bad, but we've been hearing those same types of adjectives for 15 years. So
right,
maybe it's time for pictures to bring back what gassing actually looks like and what's involved. And that's why we wanted to bring on an Army officer who is a nuclear biological chemical specialist. So he knows about that. We're going to give him a call, get him on the horn so he can actually tell us what happens when your body gets gassed. So we have the Army officer on the phone who's going to walk us through what it kind of looks like whenever somebody gets gassed. First of all, like, the chemical components, what happens to your body, and what some of these weapons that you think might have been used in Syria actually consist of.
All right, so when you're talking about, like, chemical weapons in general, there's a few classifications. You've got what they call a, like, blister agents, which is, like, mustard gas, and that's, like, everybody kind of thinks of, like, first, like, World War One type stuff. And then you've got your blood agents, which get into your bloodstream and really just kind of affect how your body works, and that's, like, cyanide and shit like that. Well, then you've got the worst of the worst. We're talking about chemical agents, which are nerve agents, and that's sarin, VX, and any what they're called organophosphates. They kind of work the same way pesticides work. And what they do is they block the nerve sensors in your nervous system that, like, tell your organs to stop working. So essentially, when you get hit with something like sarin, your body just overworks. And eventually, usually what happens is you die of respiratory failure. So your lungs literally give out because they've been working too hard because you can't shut it down. And that's probably, I just read something this morning that Turkish officials with, you know, UN oversight did autopsies, and they said, yeah, these guys, this is probably a sarin attack. I mean, if you're thinking, oh, well, how do you fix that? Atropine, which, you know, you guys know, you get the little injectors that you shove into your thigh. What that does is that blocks the sensor from the nerves in the brain, and that basically shuts your vital organs down, and it keeps you from dying. basically. So it's not really a cure.
After you're exposed to the gas, symptoms. How long would it take for you if you don't get that?
Pretty quick, like within minutes or seconds. Like it's real fast. Like you have to know that it's coming. I can't be just sitting there and like, oh shit, I feel dizzy, and then dose yourself and you're good. Like if you're feeling dizzy, like it's probably too late.
Wow. So we in the military, Cons knows, we have the gas command that you have been hit, the area that you have been hit with gas. Now, is the agent that they got hit with in Syria, would that have to be like, what level of suit would that need to be for them to survive?
Really just, if you just had a mask on, so like a pro mask, you know, respirator, that'd be fine. Like it can get through your skin, but you can wash it off. You could definitely survive like skin contact with sarin. The thing about a nerve agent, especially one like sarin, it's really volatile. So it goes to a gas pretty quickly. And that's how it's super effective is if, you inhale it. But if you've seen any of the videos and they're dousing them with water hoses, trying to get that stuff off, that's actually a pretty effective way to decontaminate yourself from sarin. And another thing about the gas itself, it's heavier than air, so it sinks. So you'll see, if you've seen the videos, and obviously the Syrians, they kind of know what's up, and they know, how to deal with this stuff. Is they, they immediately pull all these people up onto like the beds of trucks or, higher and hose them off as a way to hopefully keep them from inhaling any more gas or like having it off gas from their skin. Cause if it gets into your clothes and stuff like that, like it can off gas for like 30 minutes after. So you want to, if you get exposed to this, take off all your clothes, hose yourself down, try to get, elevated and get into some fresh air, and then just hope and pray that you did enough.
Yes. I mean, you say hope and pray. So it's not necessarily life. Well, it's obviously life threatening, but it can be
right.
Combated.
Yeah, you can
if they know what they're doing.
Survive it.
Okay.
Yeah, you can survive it. A lot of what I've kind of been reading about, what happened is, people are sitting in their homes and, the bombs came down and then, they're pulling, lifeless bodies out of apartments, and it's completely awful. And, to kind of explain, like the hardest thing about, chemical weapons is the delivery. So if you try to just, strap, a gallon of CX to, a rocket or an RPG or something like that, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. Cause when the explosion happens, it's going to destroy the agent. So, Russia came out and said, oh, it was the rebels. We hit a Syrian army hit a weapons depot that was right there, an ammunition depot. And it was full of, agent. And that's what happened. Well, that's virtually impossible because if there was an explosion that big, it would destroy all the agents. So a lot of times when you got bombs, what probably happened here is they drop bombs and there's a secondary charge inside the bomb that's a smaller explosion, but it'll disperse the gas. Mm-hmm. Or you've got, if it's a missile or a rocket, you got like a Scud, which has a warhead full of the agent. And so, primary launch and, conjure, you're an artillery guy. So you got the igniter that shoots the projectile. And right. Then as soon as it gets to where it's going, secondary explodes, smaller explosion, and disperses the agent. Ideally, you do that above the ground, mm-hmm. and then that disperses the agent, over everything. And that's what makes me think that it's, Syrian government. Like the way it's, how volatile it is and how it was delivered and how efficiently this was delivered, it just doesn't make sense anything other than Assad. And he's done it before, and well documented, 1,500 people in 2013.
Right. So it doesn't take much to connect the dots here. He can claim, oh, that wasn't me, but it's like, actually every freaking sign points to it was you.
Yeah, if you're a bedwetter and you wet the bed a few times, eventually, whenever somebody's in bed with you and you feel pissed, you're gonna know who it is.
Yeah,
right. And that's really like all it takes for me is just knowing, hey, like if you try to blow this up, like it's gonna destroy. You have to know what you're doing and how to deliver it. And there's reports. Oh well, these guys, the rebels
you know, and even ICE says, you know, oh, they have manufacturing capability. Well, that's great. Like, you can have all the manufacturing capability you want, but if you don't have the means to deliver, or the expertise or the experience to deliver, you're not going to be effective. Like, you know, you think about North Korea, for example. Sure, they have missiles that they could attach nukes to and get to us, but they don't have the technology yet to make their nukes small enough to put on a missile to get to us. You know, so you kind of have to look at, okay, do you have the capability to manufacture, and then do you also have the capability to deliver?
Yeah, it's kind of like the old adage of means, capability, intent. Do you have all of those? And if you don't have all of those, then you don't have shit.
Exactly. And Assad definitely has, you know, all three, and plus, you know, he's got his big brother to the north in Russia, you know, just defending him. And then hopefully, you know, we do something about it. I swear to God, like, Chaps, you and I are more aligned politically, and I swear to God, I'll vote for Trump if we do something about Syria in 2020, you know? Like,
yeah, man.
I didn't vote for Trump this time, but I swear if we do, like, you tweeted yesterday about kind of the combat fatigue that you get, you know? And, I mean, I was in Afghanistan during the Afghan surge in 2010-11, and, like, yeah, you get used to seeing dead bodies, you get used to seeing all that, but you never, ever, ever get used to seeing dead kids.
Yep.
And it's the worst. And I don't encourage everybody, but if you want to get, like, really pissed off, go watch one of these videos or look at some of these pictures and just understand that, like, that's their reality every day. And when you see the efficiency to which they started, like, decontaminating, like, their children and their grandmothers, you know, like,
yeah,
they know exactly what to do because that's their reality. And we need to do something about that.
Absolutely.
Well, I think me and Cons are both on the same page. No matter where you're at politically, watching kids get gas is fucking never okay.
Nope.
Thank you so much, sir, for coming on the show. Skipper, we appreciate your time, man. Thanks for your service and everything that you're doing to keep our country safe.
Hey, no problem. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Well, two great interviews back to back. I really appreciate both of those gentlemen coming on, especially the officer who risked getting in trouble, so we're not going to actually say his name, especially since he gave a little bit of political talk there at the end.
Yeah.
So
no, but that was insightful.
I
think
it was very insightful.
Most folks have no idea how chemical agents work, so thank you to him for joining us, and certainly to Thomas giving us that perspective as a journalist and a Marine. But I will say something we didn't talk about, but something that really bothered me this week when we heard about these attacks were Spicer's comments, the official White House comments about these attacks. And obviously they acknowledge that they are horrific and heinous, but they said, oh, by the way, this isn't our fault. This is all because something Obama did. I'm sick of that shit. I'm sick of it. I don't care if it's something that Obama did in 2012, to that whenever. You know, just like people who said, like, oh, well, President Clinton, he could have gotten bin Laden, we had eyes on in 2000. I don't care. If it didn't happen, then now this is your problem, President Trump. This is your issue to deal with. I don't want to hear about that. Take the necessary actions that you want to deal with it and move forward. Stop talking about Obama, because guess what? Whatever he did, whether his decision was right or wrong, he made it. And now we have to live with those consequences. So
okay,
I want,
for those that didn't actually hear the statement, I'll read it.
Yeah, please do. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I actually risk reading. It says, and nobody better fucking make fun of my reading today. Today's chemical attack in Syria. Nope, we're going to start over already. Today's chemical attack in Syria against innocent people, including women and children, is reprehensible and cannot be ignored by the civilized world. These heinous acts by Bashar al-Assad's regime are a consequence of the past administration weakness and irresolution. President Obama said in 2012 that we should establish a red line, in quotes, against the use of chemical weapons, and then did nothing. The United States stands with our allies across the globe to condemn this intolerable attack.
That statement, that part about Obama adds nothing. It's
nothing,
just complaining.
Dude.
We talked about accountability.
If you're a high school editor editing a ninth grade paper, you would cross out the part where he started with President Obama, the past administration's weakness and irresolution. You would cross it out and be like, what the fuck does that have to do with anything?
Nothing. I'm tired of it because we talked about accountability. Now this is your problem, President Trump. And granted, you know, now they're waiting to see how the UN is going to act, because guess what? The UN needs to act, because when we're talking about chemical weapons, we are talking about war crimes. And as we talked about in our interviews, connect the dots. You're going to hear it here first on Zero Block 30. I'm putting the stake in the ground. It was Assad.
Yeah.
So he needs to be persecuted for war crimes in the international court. Because
take his ass to the Hague, man.
Yeah, exactly. Take him to the Hague, because you cannot use these weapons. You know, I heard someone, I was talking to someone yesterday, and they were saying, well, what about like people who used napalm in Vietnam? And I actually, you know, when I studied the law of war, napalm is actually by the book a legal weapon. Now, granted, it was when it was used.
It's still despicable, though.
It's despicable. When it was used, though, it ended up harming people much the same way chemical weapons do, you know, women, children, in heinous ways. We won't get into the nitty-gritty of that, but when it comes down to it, chemical weapons are despicable, and this Assad needs to be dealt with, so we do not need to wait too long for the UN to act. I think, and I'm not saying we need to jump in and get involved, but we need to be putting pressure on the UN to act. We can't just be sitting around waiting, twiddling our thumbs, we need to say, hey, UN, if you're going to do something, now's the time. We can't just keep waiting around for the next attack to happen.
Yeah, you can't take credit for job supports and the economy doing well while throwing blame in other places. If you're going to say that things are happening because of you, then they're happening for you because of all reasons.
Yeah.
And it's not just Trump. Trump isn't the first one that did it. Obama did it with Bush,
yep.
And it was fucking stupid then. And Bush did it with Clinton. Like, it was stupid there.
Yeah.
So it's always stupid. Stop fucking passing the buck. You're the main guy. Take fucking responsibility. And this isn't even something that he had to take responsibility for.
No.
He comes out and issues the first part. It's irreprehensible and cannot be ignored by the civilized world. These heinous actions by Assad regime are a consequence. And he just moves on. The United States stands with our allies across the globe to condemn this intolerable attack. He just says that, and it's fine. And that's what a president should do.
Bingo.
There's no reason to be fucking petty, man.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's a great word. That's what it is. It's petty. It's petty.
It's petty as fuck. And then him bringing up, like, continuing to bring up that he beat Clinton. We know, dude. We know.
you got the, you know, the 1600 Pennsylvania Ave. It's addressed to Donald Trump,
man.
These days.
You have two White Houses. You have one in fucking Mar-a-Lago, and you have one in Washington, D.C. We know you won, dude.
Yeah.
Stop saying scoreboard. Fucking do something.
So anyway.
I know you have.
Well, we got a badass of the week. And I do have an announcement, but we got a badass of the week. We haven't had one in a while, and then something popped up in the news that, you know, I thought I was like, hey, this is a great tale of perseverance and overcoming a lot to accomplish your goals. And our badass of the week this week is Sidney Cole. Sidney Cole is a 102-year-old World War II veteran who served with both Canadian and American forces and survived captivity by the Nazis. He dropped out of his Buffalo, New York high school in the 30s, and he was initially rejected by the U.S. Army Air Corps. So he said, all right, that's fine. I still want to fight. So he jumped across the border, as our friends Todd and Gordo will tell you. Buffalo is very close to Canada. So he joined the Canadian Royal Air Force, and then he was discharged. And then right after the Japanese attacks on Pearl Harbor is when he was discharged, and he joined the U.S. Army in 1943, and he was shot down during the Battle of the Bulge, and he spent 4 months in a German POW camp. And the reason I said he was the badass of the week is because he just got his diploma last Friday, his high school diploma, and 10 medals that were due to him, including a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star. You know, when you're 102 years old, I can't imagine the high school diploma is high on your priority list. But that was probably just something that was, you know, bouncing around in his brain, something he wanted to do. So good on Sidney Cole to go back and get that high school diploma. And very happy to see that he was awarded those medals that he was due.
Hell yeah, man. Love these old folks.
Yeah.
And it's 100 years since World War I started. So that's pretty incredible. Just in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like the images that are coming out from there. Like, I love seeing them doing shit like in Thomas's article where you see the guy sitting around shaving. everything is the exact same.
Like, yeah,
they're using
right.
their silver little canteen cup. Like, that's the way that we shave too. And it sucked. I'm sure it sucked.
Yeah.
In, 1917, just like it does in 2017.
I'm absolutely.
Sure the same thing.
Yep.
Any save rounds, alibis? Oh, you had your.
Yeah. So I do have a save round alibi. I have a great announcement to make, and I've been waiting a few weeks to make this announcement, but we had to finalize all the details, and we finally signed the contract. So, Armed Forces Day, May 20th, in Boston, Massachusetts, Operation Heal Our Heroes is proud to present the summer kickoff Freedom Cruise. We are going to be setting sail, and shout to our guy, Joe Cardona, friend of the program, Patriots long snapper. He will be in attendance, as will hopefully some of his teammates, as they will be in OTAs, and some other local professional athletes hopefully will be in attendance. But we're going to do a cruise around the Boston Harbor. You're going to get dinner. You're going to get a premium open bar. You're going to get entertainment. You're going to get some silent auctions. You're going to get some raffles for some cool prizes with the local sports teams, hopefully. So it's going to be a great night, and you know, I couldn't think of a better way to kick off the summer one weekend early than a cruise around Boston. So look for me to be posting all this information on various social media, and the website will be up soon so you can buy your tickets and make your donations to Operation Heal Our Heroes. And we are going to take all of our proceeds from the event and donate them to a local Boston charity that works with veterans as we try to establish our footprint throughout the country. So I really hope a lot of people can make it on May 20th. So that's it.
Hell yeah. Sound the retreat.